Okay, let's turn to your questions. Alan, what role do you think the Simpson-Bowles Commission had on subsequent budgetary discussion and legislation?
Well, I think everybody talked about it. We delivered it on December 1st of 2010 after working about 8 months, and it was a good, solid group of people. It took us 3 months to establish trust. There's no trust in Washington anymore, even in the parties, intra-party. There's no trust. The trust was the coin of the realm when we were there. That coin is severely tarnished. So after 3 months, we could begin to talk with each other so that somebody wouldn't run out and there'd be a light of a television camera like a giant moth. They'd go out there and blow all the stuff to bits as to what we'd been talking about in private. Anyway, we delivered it, and the president walked away from it. He couldn't have touched it because people say, what happened there? If he would have been torn to bits by his base, because in there is entitlement reform. And if he had voted for it, I think the Republicans, in their passion to get him, would have voted against it unanimously. They would have caucused to vote no. So we visited with everybody. It's out there. It's a 67-page report. It's in English. It uses terms like shared sacrifice, which has not been used in this country since World War II, and it used phrases like going broke. And it describes, we didn't touch SSI, we didn't hurt, we didn't do anything with food stamp. Everybody that brings up some tragic thing we're doing to humans is a lie. We paid careful attention, or we wouldn't have had a vote from Dick Durbin to Tom Coburn and in between. And so there it is, and it will be a template. It's out there. As they continue to do nothing, a disability insurance will be gone in 2 years. DI, zero. Social Security in the year 2033, according to the trustees, or Democrats and Republicans of high repute, in Social Security, by doing nothing, in 2033, you're going to waddle up to the window and get a check for 23% less. 10,000 a day are turning, 65. And when I was a freshman, like these young people in college, there were 15 people paying into Social Security and one taking out. Today, there are 3 people paying in and one taking out. Social Security is not a retirement program. It hadn't a damn thing to do with retirement. It was an income supplement to take care of guys digging ditches in the late 30s and give them 43% of the replacement rate of what they were getting when they were digging the ditch. All of the demographics are shot to hell. Raise the retirement age. We said, let's raise it. It's going to be 67 in the year 2027. And we said, as Barney would, raise the wages subject to the tax. That's fine with us. We recommend that. We recommend changing the bend points so it's more progressive and you hit the rich more than you hit the poor. We recommended all sorts of things to make it work. Give the lower 20% 125% of poverty. That costs, but we built that in. Give 80 to 85 a kick of 1% a year on up. And the point is, you can't believe the shriek we got when we said, we'll raise the retirement age to 68 by the year 2050. And the AARP said, how will everybody ever be able to... I tell you. If I didn't learn to make faces, I know he'll get me, but, I mean...
Well, but now I got to say, I very much agree with you that we should discuss differences civilly. I didn't think that was very civil, but because there are some legitimate differences, and I agree with much of that. But here's my problem. You say Social Security is not a retirement program, but for a lot of people it is. I wish it were different.
I wish it was.
But I wish I could eat more and not gain weight, so I can't just act on my wishes. And the fact is that I agree with much of what you propose, but when we are talking about those people for whom it is 70, 80, up to 100% of their income, and they're living on $2,000 or $2,200 a month, I would not reduce the amount they would get going forward on the cost of living. So I think we should do most of this. But, I mean, that's my problem with shared sacrifice. Who is the Frenchman? The law gives the rich and the poor alike the right to sleep under bridges. I and you do some of that, but I want to, with regard to Social Security, when you have people for whom it is a very large amount of money, that's why my proposal, and we agree on this, tax away Social Security for people who have other income. But where Social Security is their sole income, it wasn't intended to be that way. And look, we know this is a problem because the private pension system that was supposed to be an alternative has crumbled. We got to do something for people.
Well, it's described as a retirement. I'm just saying that the origin of it was not a retirement, but people have accepted it.
But it's become that way.
I agree with that. But the point is, we were trying to adapt to that.
One of the things that troubles me, and this is not you making this argument, it's other people who say, well, Social Security, it was okay because when Social Security was first put in, people were dead by 67, so it didn't cost so much. You've heard that argument. The answer is, oh, apparently Franklin Roosevelt was engaged in a great gotcha. Hey, I got this great retirement program, but you'll be dead before it can do you any good. I don't think that's the model we ought to be taking forward. I understand that's not you, but you'll see people say that. Well, you got to cut it because people are living too goddamn long.
Well, it is a curious thing to mention Social Security in society, and the nastiest letters I get are from people over 60. Vicious, vicious, nasty, oh. But I send them a response. And my beautiful wife of 60 years, and Barney knows her, and Leon, and Sylvia, and she said, you're not pressing the button and sending that, are you? It just says, dear sir or madam, you need a pane of glass in your navel so you can see out during the day.
It's funny also,
the form
I
letter.
Also want to talk about, on the retirement age, and again, you got to differentiate. People are living longer, but people are living longer divided by socioeconomic status. And some people are living longer than other people. And there are people who are still doing physical labor. There are women who started carrying heavy trays of dishes when they were 18.
We built all that into our proposal. Every bit of that is in there. And the president embraced the chain CPI, your president.
And I think
and mine.
He was wrong.
Yeah, I know, but everybody else thought he was right.
No, not everybody else.
The Democrats,
excuse me.
Everybody else.
If everybody else thought that you were right, how come it's not the law right now?
Because they're scared to death of the AARP, for God's sake.
That's a mistake that you make that's misleading.
That isn't a mistake.
No, it is not the AARP. If there was no 50. AARP, Alan, you have people disagree with you. It's okay to say they're wrong, but don't blame the AARP for conjuring up what would happen.
You're kidding.
By the public.
They ran full-page ads of people
I know,
with tears streaming
down
their cheeks.
And I know a lot of constituents, and I had a lot of constituents who never paid much attention to AARP who felt that way on their own. It's like some of the liberals who blame the NRA for our inability to get gun control. It's a convenient way to sort of wish away the voters. But here's my point on this. On the chain CPI, the chain CPI reduces the amount that people will now get in the future to compensate for a cost of living. If you have got someone living on $2,000 a month, I don't want to reduce what they get. I don't know how we can talk about worrying about inequality and then say, but older people who have $2,000 a month and no chance of making any outside income, we're going to reduce what they would otherwise get. So I want to do it by taxing things away, but that's what the chain CPI does. It takes unless, is there a cutoff? At what point below which do people not get the chain
Why
CPI?
Why would your compassionate president ever embrace as a horrid thing?
But, I don't know, but that's not a sensible argument.
Well, let me take control
because,
of this.
Because he won. I'll tell
it
you
doesn't
what,
take anything away.
I don't
it
know
lowers
why.
The cola.
Right.
It
lowers the amount. It lowers the amount someone living on $2,000 a year in downtown Boston would get a couple years from now. And I don't know why the president wants to keep spending billions of dollars a year in Afghanistan. He doesn't always check with me, and I think he's sometimes wrong.
All right. Well, I'll deal
by the
with
way,
him
by
later.
The way, the answer for to the question that was addressed to you is that the Congress.
What was the question?
As to whether anything's been done with Simpson-Mazzoli in effecting legislation. The answer is no.
No.
They haven't done any reform.
Time out. We got Leon so rattled that he just asked him what happened to Simpson-Mazzoli, which was the immigration bill we passed 30 years ago.
We did that.
Yes, we did that.
Barney and I did that.
All right, Barney, any chance we can return to separation of commercial and investment banking functions?
Well, ask him that, hell, I'm not going to answer that.
We took a step towards that with the Volcker Rule. Beyond that, I don't think it is necessary to go. That, for people who don't follow it as closely, that separation was embodied in the Glass-Steagall Act that was adopted at the outset of the 30s. And there were some who say, well, we could have avoided the problem. I should tell you, and again, sometimes the argument for authority works, even Elizabeth Warren repudiates that. The new things that caused the crisis were unaffected by Glass-Steagall. Derivatives, making loans. Under Glass-Steagall, there was nothing that would have stopped the bank from making loans to people who shouldn't have paid them back, packaging them in a security, and selling them. Glass-Steagall didn't touch that. We do, in the Volcker Rule, separate out. As Alan said, it gets you back to more serious banking. Beyond that, I don't see that any problem grew out of the fact that some banks were doing both. What the Volcker Rule says is, we want you to do less risky activities because we insure your money through federal deposit insurance. But I don't see Glass-Steagall any further separation with one exception. We do have in the bill the power to regulators to do that institution by institution. They do have the power to say to a particular institution, you are not running yourself well, and we need to slim you down by taking this out of there. The final point about a total separation, you really could be mandating a fire sale. That is, if you made every institution that had both of these divest over the next couple of years, you're talking about lowering the assets because there are not nearly enough borrowers with enough money to take it on.
Barney, there's another question in here that I should ask you at this point. Do you regret your vote to repeal Glass-Steagall in the waning days of the Clinton administration?
No, and I'm glad you asked that. And the reason I don't regret my vote to repeal Glass-Steagall is that I voted against repealing Glass-Steagall. So there was a nice example of... no, I voted against repealing Glass-Steagall. I did not think Glass-Steagall still made sense in its terms, but I voted against repealing it because it did not come up with new regulation. I thought that we should have new regulation. So the answer is I voted not to repeal... I voted against the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
What would both of you think of a performance-based pay scale for Congress members?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure how that would work, but
I don't know. But they put bills in like that all the time so they can get reelected, but they don't care about it. But the best performance is at the ballot box, yeah, and I really believe. Naively, I've been accused of that always in life, public life, but I really believe that when things are going to get worse, when the tipping point comes, I don't know what that will mean. I know that I agree with Durbin. It will not be good. Interest rates will kick up and won't have a thing to do with who did what to who, and inflation will kick up. But at that point, I think that people are going to... When the guy goes down to borrow to send his kid to the community college and he's been borrowing at 2 or 3% and suddenly it's 5 or 6, he's going to say, who did this? On whose watch did this come about? And it's going to be the guy that got up at every town meeting with his constituents and said, I know the problem and we can correct it without touching precious Medicare, precious Medicaid, precious defense, and precious Social Security. And then you want to say to that person, you are telling a terminological inexactitude. Barney would like that. And then just call him a lion SOB. And at that point, they're going to go back and say, you did this and we're going to take you out. Yeah, Democrat or Republican, that will be the solution.
I think I agree with Alan, it's at the ballot box. You talk about the performance. Well, nobody serves in the House of Representatives who didn't get more votes than anybody else in the last election. And with only occasional exceptions, when somebody dies and there's an appointment, that's true in the Senate. If you went into a hotel and when you parked, the guy took your car and banged it into the wall, and then the guy taking your baggage kicked it, and it fell open. And you got to the desk, and they didn't have a room for you. And you got to the room, and it was dirty. You would say, who runs this place? Who hired these people? Well, you hired the congressman. I didn't. I voted. Look, I voted for one guy for 32 years. That was me. I was pretty satisfied. I wasn't. I said, look, we three had an experience that very few people in this room had. We once voted for someone who we knew was perfect. By the time we ran for re-election, that wasn't true anymore. We knew we had a couple of things. But I mean, that's part of the problem but it's what Alan said before. The public allows itself to get bored off its concern for general reform by specific bribes, by people are with them on this specific thing. And, you know, that's the answer. You want performance. If you say to me, oh, this member of the House or Senate is so bad that his or her salary should only be 30%, what does that say about the people who voted him in? That's where the cause came.
We talked about this earlier, and I just want to raise it again. Money and politics. The recent Supreme Court decision that eliminated any limits with regards to, I guess, PAC contributions, et cetera, and it's going to unleash a lot more money in politics. How big a role is money in politics playing with regards to the kind of gridlock we're seeing?
Well, I'm a master of lost causes, and there was a group called Americans for Campaign Reform, consists of Bill Bradley, Bob Kerry, Warren Rudman, bless him, we all knew him, he was a wonderful guy, and myself, four of us. And we've been talking about federal financing of congressional campaigns, doing it through the states, cost about $1.6 billion, and that's a lot less than the earmarks piles and all the rest of the stuff that go with it. But down to the issue, we have been disemboweled by the previous Supreme Court decision and this latest one, and we're all lawyers, and you respect the law and you respect the court system. That is the worst opinion I can imagine in the history of this country. Because if you think a guy's going to cough up, if you think one of these fine high school guys is going to turn 18 and put $5 to their favorite candidate, and look at this typhoon of a guy who's putting up 10 million or 15 and anonymously, I think this if people thought Congress was corrupt and on the take now, when they're finished with the next, I think Barney said it today, give them a couple more sessions to iron this baby out, and when they see that the guy who laid 50 million, and don't forget the Dems are in this as deep, the Koch brothers may be the evil poster, but George Soros is not St. Francis either. And so they're in it, they're all in it together, and they're going to go elect their guy, and why do you think they're going to do that? For access. You don't do it for patriotism, you do it for access. And I think it's just the worst. It's the worst I've ever seen in all my life of watching the court and being a lawyer. We're all lawyers.
No, I agree with that. And there's a fundamental philosophical issue here. And I keep talking about the private sector and the public sector. The private sector is supposed to be the place where the more money you have, the more influence you have. That's the free market system. You do have inequality there. The person who figures out better what the consumer wants is going to wind up with more money and can produce more of what the consumer wants, and you get a more efficient system. But the political system is supposed to be based on perfect equality, one person, one vote. And what the Supreme Court has done is to tear down that wall so that the inequality principle, whereby the more money you have, the more influence you have, washes over the equality principle, and it dilutes democracy. There isn't any question about it. The only difference I would have with Alan is this: about I agree that there are some Democrats who are in it as much, but they are in it more in self-defense. This was a partisan thing. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions, it pretty much breaks down. The vote, it correlates to the vote on Bush-Gore, and who appointed whom. Democratic versus the Republican appointees. The courts aren't supposed to work that way, but on some issues they do. And the only way out of this depends on the 2016 presidential election. If the person who wins the 2016 presidential election is someone who agrees with these recent court decisions, then it will get baked in. If it's someone who disagrees, there were 5-4 decisions. They are not sufficiently rooted so that there would be a reluctance to overturn them. And if the next president is someone elected in 2016 who disagrees with them and has 8 years, demographics strongly argue that he or she will get the right to replace enough justices. So I wish there were other ways to do it. But that's going to be one of the factors in the 2016 election. What will the Supreme Court justices appointed by that presidential candidate do to the system? Because Alan is right. And by the way, it's not so much that people once in office will be influenced by campaign contributions. You won't have to influence them. You'll own them from the beginning. You can put that kind of money in there. You'll elect your kind of people. And the subsequent stuff won't be important.
You know, the real distortion is that the First Amendment is the only one on the books that was for a person. The First Amendment was for a person. It's the only one that really is for people. And the court before this, you know, decision, in the last one, have now assumed a role of corporate personhood. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as corporate personhood. It's a total distortion of the First Amendment as to free speech.
Let me ask you, as long as you raise the issue, who will be the candidate for the Democrats and who will be the candidate for the Republicans in 2016? Barney?
If Hillary Clinton wants to run for president, and I cannot imagine that she doesn't, then why would you want to have been as involved and not be the president? She will be the Democratic nominee without any serious contest.
Alan, Republicans?
Well, if we have this continual thing with the Tea Party movement and the social issues, let's just get to that and let me address that because of my, I think most people agree that abortion is a hideous thing. I can't imagine anything worse. But I practiced law and had a couple of clients who said, if I have another child, I'm going to commit suicide, and they did. I practiced law in real life. I never was in a corporate tower. I did murder, incest, rape, divorce, all of that. And I loved it because you were doing things with human beings. But abortion is a horrible thing, but what in the world? It's a deeply intimate and personal decision and a tough one beyond anybody's rationale, and I don't think men legislators should even vote on it. Now, and then this issue of gay lesbian issues and gay marriage. I had a cousin who was a World War II hero with a Silver Star and saved people on the battlefields of Europe. I had a lesbian cousin who was a music teacher, the most beautiful person, inspired more people probably in music and the arts than anybody I knew. And what is that all about? We're all God's children. We're all human beings. Barney, I didn't know when Barney, I used to tell Barney a lot of jokes. And some of them were very bad. And one day he came out. And I called him, I said, Barney, wait a minute, Barney, that one I told you about 2 months ago. He said, Al, did you ever see Torchlight Trilogy? Well, I never had. He said, well, those are the ones we can tell among ourselves. The point is, I've had a happy marriage. What's to prevent him from having a happy marriage, or her, or anybody out there? What is that? So,
You're avoiding the Republican candidate for president. Well,
okay, but you can't have the guys in there where we could have had 4 U.S. Senate seats. Mike Castle, you worked with 5, and that woman was into witchcraft, so we have to watch. Then there was the guy who talked about legitimate rape. That was a beautiful thing. And then we could have beat old Harry Reid like a bongo drum, and he found the goofiest opponent, and he supported her.
Worked
with
hard
his
to get
fun.
Her nominated. Worked hard to help her get nominated.
Yeah, he helped her get, because he knew he could pick her off. So, all I'm saying, what I'm watching here, is Rand Paul is suddenly switching to centrist. he's abandoning Cruz and Lee, which is that Cruz is the one I said, you know, if your horse drops dead, it's better to get off. But then Scott Walker is out there. They're drilling his teeth now, and Christie is out there. Jeb Bush is out there apparently back. But I don't know. I just know that if we will drop the social issues and move on to the biggest issue confronting America, as you've said, and you is the debt. How do we handle this overbearing debt? And it's just continuing if we're just going to. But anyway, I don't know who's out there, but if we have a chance. We have a chance if they'll just put this stuff in the back porch and move with. What do you do with America? Its future, its
tough,
economy,
tough,
the job.
It's tough to do in the primaries. That's the problem.
That's why I think, as I said, as a Democrat, the wackier the Republican Senate candidate, the better we are, but that's not good for the country. And there literally are five seats now, Colorado, Delaware, Missouri, Indiana, and Nevada, where there were Democratic senators who would almost certainly have lost to more reasonable, we're not talking liberal Republicans, to mainstream conservative Republicans. And I think the big issue is going to be in 2016, and there were some analogs. 1964 on the Republican side, 1972 on the Democratic side, the true believers won. You got Barry Goldwater in 64, George McGovern in 72. They are the two biggest losers in American presidential history, those two elections. And in consequence, both parties after that went to more centrist, not centrist, but moved more to the center. Because here's the thing about the extremes, and it's been reinforced by this parallel media universe. They are convinced that they are the majority. And if you argue with them, you say, you're going to lose with this guy. Oh, no, no. Look at all those people who don't vote. The ideological true believers always claim the non-voters as their silent supporters. And they believe that's going to happen. And so, my interesting optimistic scenario is, the Republican Party in 2016 cannot cleanse itself of this, loses badly, but as a consequence, then says, okay, we have no option. We have to confront this, and we have to get back to a more traditional Democratic-Republican
kind of opposition. Well, that's what Clinton did with your Democrat Party when he got going with the Democratic Central.
Yep. But his victory... The seeds for that were set with the McGovern defeat, and then again with the Mondale defeat. That's so true. That's what I think is likely.
Let me ask this: there is this new book that's out called "Capital in the 21st Century," and the conclusion of it is that there's tremendous income inequality in the United States. He compares it actually to the period going back to 1914, that the distribution of wealth is pretty much the same as it was in 1914, with the upper percentage getting most of the income. And the question here is, at the current rate of growing inequality, do you believe that the middle class's survival is at risk? What is the government's role or responsibility in sustaining and encouraging the growth of a middle class?
Well, that's my third function for the public sector. I mean, there's the basic functions that nobody does, like police and fire, that the private sector doesn't do. They're setting the rules. And this book by Thomas Piketty says that there is an inherent tendency in the free market system to exacerbate inequality because over time, in a normal situation, the return on capital will exceed the return on labor. And if you don't want inequality to continue to grow, and we're talking about too much inequality. No one rational should be talking about getting rid of inequality. It's essential for the economic system to function, and in a reasonable amount, it's desirable. But I think that is an argument. So it's partly through the tax system. Alan and the commission, they talked about going after some of these tax preferences which disproportionately help the wealthiest people. I believe it is means putting into effect a system for the financing of higher education so that that can be broadly accessed by young people from less affluent, middle-class, working-class families, so they can go forward. I also believe, if you look at the history of the United States and some other places, particularly in America, because we didn't have the negative aspects of this, in what helped people make money, that strong labor unions, collective bargaining are important, especially since if we talk about labor unions now, we're not talking about organizing manufacturing where you might have some international competition. I think there is an important role for labor unions in the service area, in the fast food area, in the retail area in general. And I would, if we were to be able to get a reversal of the anti-labor union attitudes and laws that have been in there, labor unions have been an important transmission belt for people to be into the middle class.
Alan, we've got about two to three minutes. Go ahead.
Well, he's absolutely right when he's mentioning those kind of unions. My father was a union member. He was a member of the United Mine Workers. But you got to do something with the municipal unions.
They're a separate category.
You got to do something with the firemen and the policemen because they get in there. And I'm telling you, their systems all, and, you know, look at Detroit. I mean, you don't, I'm not anti-union, but I'll tell you, Service Workers Union, Andy Stern was on our commission. And he said, after a few months, he said, I wish I'd have voted for it. His will be the biggest union in the world, the service workers. But it is the union movement, you can't get rid of collective bargaining. That's the lodestar of unions. You can do other things, but as I say, mine would be to do something with municipal unions. Now, what the hell was the question?
I would accept that.
You also, Alan, you also talked about tax reform.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The tax reform.
Well, what we found is an extraordinary thing. We got into the tax code, and we found 180-plus things called tax expenditures. They went in the 60s. They are spending by any other name. And what are they? Well, home mortgage interest deduction of employee health care, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, life insurance, parking for employees, on and on and on, charitable contributions, municipal bond interest. So you're messing around in big time. So we say, let's get rid of all of them. Just scrub them flat and give people what they've been talking about. Give them, you pay from zero to 70 grand, you pay 8%. 70 grand to 210, you pay 14. Anything over that, you pay 23. Take the corporate rate and 26 from 36 and go to a territorial system where you can bring it back without it getting hit. And as Erskine says, guys in my party said, well, you can't do that. They'll just use it to buy stock and give dividends. And Erskine said, well, what the hell's wrong with that? But I'll tell you one thing. We found only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the tax code. Run that up the poll one more time. Only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the code, and only 27% itemize. Alan. So that means they don't even know what the hell's in the code.
Ladies and gentlemen, would
Wait
you
a minute,
please
I...
thank these two wonderful people for their presentation.